ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Aisha Jahangir grew up in the remote tribal areas of Western Pakistan. Her family is Afghan, and they ended up on the Pakistan side of the border during partition, which left them cut off from their homeland. The village that Aisha grew up in was rural and very conservative. And so her parents moved the family to big city Lahore so Aisha could get a decent education. And in 2012, Aisha went to Afghanistan for the very first time as a journalist to cover the changes in a homeland that she'd never known. This was a wild and exciting time to be in Afghanistan, but also somewhat dangerous for female journalists. After a failed kidnapping attempt, Aisha eventually moved to Australia to do her PhD in peace and conflict journalism. This wasn't an easy path for her to take. She literally fought tooth and nail to get out of her first husband's house in Pakistan to do all of this. Hello, Aisha.
Hi, Richard.
You grew up, like I said, on the border of Pakistan with Afghanistan. What was your village like? Can you paint a picture of it for me?
Sure. First of all, we do not acknowledge that as a border. It's a colonial line and thus called the Durand Line. And it's still contested among Pashtuns and the broader Afghan population. My village was about an hour drive from where the line is. It was derelict. You see more potholes on those roads than the houses, mud houses. My grandfather was a shepherd. He, rest in peace now, he told me when he was 13, he wanted to invest in sheep and buffaloes because that could make him more money. And so he tells me that he bought his first buffalo and a pair of sheep at the age of 13. He was the only son to his parents at the time. And so that's the village. Years and years later, my grandfather's house is the only house that's a bricked house constructed by people in that area, of course. There are no televisions in the houses. Not that they don't know that televisions exist, but they don't need them. They don't want them. They don't rely on them. Their life does not revolve around what's happening outside the village, as many, many other tribal villages in the world. The main source of information is the radio, but that too is in the hands of the male, a patriarch of the household, because according to them, women really don't need to be part of what's happening outside the house.
Right, so the man decides when the radio goes on and off?
Yes, and the man also decides who becomes the audience in the room when the radio is going on. There are girls and boys' schools until high school. There's no college or university there. But girls usually go until grade 2 or 3, and just when they're about to start puberty and their physical change, you know, their physical changes in their body, they are then supposed to leave public spaces and just be contained or confined to their houses. And then the search for the husband begins, because before she comes out of that puberty, she needs to be wedded, ideally within the village.
Are these unwed girls allowed to sort of pretty much be themselves though within the family house, or do they have to cover up even there?
So there's a specific dress that married women wear. There's specific things that married women can do. For instance, put lipstick on the lower lip. So that's a tradition. My grandma tells me it comes from the fact that before the partition, the Indian and Pakistan partition, the subcontinent, there were a lot of Hindu families that lived here. And so a lot of the traditions that we have in our family, in the village and in that part, have been transferred from that culture.
So even though it's still quite pious in a Muslim sense, there are still the old Hindu traditions that still live on there?
They are. And for instance, I'll give you an example. When a woman is wed, she wears the bridal dress, which is a very ethnic Pashtun tribal, you know, dress that she wears. It's beautiful, colorful. But the moment she leaves the house, she need to be covered in a white fabric as a shroud to depict that this is her body, her soul, her being leaving her father's house and never to return. That is a very old traditional Hindu culture, if I can say, where it says that when a woman leaves, that's it. She can never come back to her husband's house, which is not a Pashtun thing, actually. If you go into Afghanistan and into other Pashtun villages or setups or how they live their house, Pashtun women are always welcome to come back to their father's house. It's just an amalgamation of so many cultures, because when we moved from the western borders to the eastern borders of the country, which is closer to India, we were living 14 kilometers from India, the border. So there, again, there's a lot of the Indian culture and influence. So when I was living there, a lot of people would question me for being so independent in a household. And when I say household, I'm talking about husbands and wife relationship. In a Pashtun society, yes, it's a patriarchal society, but inside a house, a woman does have a say. Yes, it's limited to family and house and children, but it's much more independent. And also there's no concept of dowry, which is a very, again, Indian and Hindu thing. And so when I was growing up in Punjab now, not in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, closer to India, and when I was getting married for the first time, I was expected, and my parents were expected, to provide a lot of dowry, furnish the entire house, carpet, make cupboards. There were arguments between my mother-in-law-to-be at that time and my mother about, no, we don't do this. We are not going to build a cupboard in your house. So it's very fascinating, and of how I've been navigating my entire life between being a Pashtun, growing up in a non-Pashtun society. So I became a migrant from a very early age within my country.
There was still this Indian form of tattooing in your part of the world too, wasn't there?
It was, yes. And you remind me of the beautiful tattoos that my grandmother and my aunts had at that time. So a bunch of needles, about 100 of them, small ones, depending on how big you need the tattoo, stashed together and then dipped in a specific kind of dye, and needs to be, it is just like a done with your hand. So you just keep poking that part of the body.
Like a prison tattoo, like a, in
yeah,
Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
That's similar kind of tattoo.
Yeah, yes. It's like the one they use bamboo sticks and they just keep, you know, hammering that place with that needles.
And where would the tattoo be?
So again, it depends on what age you are and what do you want to depict. So mostly it used to be on the lower lip. I don't know what was this fascination with the lower lip, lipstick on the lower lip, tattoo on the lower lip, but it had to be in a circle, as a circle which is half on your lip and half under your lip. And so my grandmother had it and I absolutely loved it. I often tease my mom and say, I really want to have that. And my mom's really aversive to any tattoos on the face. There were also the ones that are close to the eyes on the temples, but they were smaller dots. So it was basically to enhance the beauty of the eye.
And are they really ornate as well and really cut finely detailed?
They are. I mean, the ones closer to the eye, they're very intricate and very small, and they can be in a diamond shape, probably three diamonds together, making one larger shape of a diamond. But the ones under the lip, they are circular, as if you've just drawn them with a compass, and they stay. But then there are ones on the back of your hand as well, just above your fingers. And that must hurt, but they're beautiful. And I think the older I'm growing, I don't know if it's the standard of this age where you, at this age, you just feel like you want to go back to your roots. And so I've been...
You're still thinking about it?
I've been thinking about it. I'm not sure about the face tattoo, but maybe on the hands for sure.
You're talking there about the marriage traditions. How old was your mom when she got married?
Well, my mom was 15. She had me when she was 16.
Did she go through that routine of wearing white and the mourning from leaving the family
home?
Yeah,
so now again, there's another level or a layer of, you know, intersectional cultural sensitivities and protocols, as I must say. So my grandfather from my mom's side is a Pashtun, but he comes from the lineage of Genghis Khan. So Genghis Khan, as I would say it in English. So Mongols. And he would often tell me that the sign, if you're a Mongol or not, is that you grow hair from inside your ears. And so I don't know if it was a joke or not.
It's a joke.
But I still, so when...
You believed it though.
I did. And I think this is what we grew up. Now that my husband and I often tease with him and I say, I've got some Mongol blood. And so the other day my son was telling me he's got a little bit of hair on one of his ears. And I said, yeah, that's because a part of you is Mongol.
Well, you know when I was talking earlier about this village being a remote part of the world, but of course... For millennia, it was one of the Silk Roads coming through there. This is Waziristan we're talking about, isn't it? So
it is.
This is the Silk Roads where Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist culture and Mongol culture all intersect. They're passing through that part of the world to go from one part to another on these long trade routes and routes of conquest.
Yeah,
and they've lasted for millennia.
This place has written documented history of 5,000 years. What happened before 5,000 years, there may be signs, but for now there is documented history. And Pashtuns have been living in this part of the world for over 5,000 years now. When I asked my parents about my mother, specifically about her side, she got married and she then had to settle with my father's setup, which was very conservative, nomadic. My mum's mum, my grandmother, often used to say that about my father's side, that these are nomads. So you don't know what their next step is going to be. Literally living in mud houses, you don't know where will they go next. But my mother's side was settled. They were rather progressive, a bit more educated. So girls had gone and seen the school. They loved music. On my father's side, nobody listens to music. Not a single person.
So this is the door that opened for you then? Because I am talking here to Dr. Aisha Jahangir at the moment. Yeah, and you've nonetheless grown up as a tiny, in this kind of regional, little, very conservative village there. Is that something your mum wanted for you then?
Oh, I think 100%. My father became that support. I think my mum became that ceiling and my father became that walls for that house. I think my grandfather also realized that towards the end, the decision to move from Khyber Pakhtunkhwa's tribal areas to a progressive city like Lahore, and when I say progressive, I mean there were better schooling opportunities, better job opportunities, and women didn't even cover. It was not mandatory for women. So I'm talking about the same country, just 500, 600, 700 kilometers away. Women are not required to cover their face or their bodies. Growing up, I had two sections of the cupboard. One was when I go and visit my family. It included a burqa. So yes, I used to wear one. The maximum choice that we used to get was, do you want the white one or the black one, the silk one or the georgette, you know? But living in Lahore, we were rather progressive. And this was also one of the concerns that my father's family had. You're growing up your daughters in a very open, according to them, environment. And it's going to come back biting at you because she's going to bring a man home who's not going to be a Pashtun and say, and now I want to get married to this man. So yes, my mother. And I think a lot had to do with the fact that she wanted to be a doctor and she couldn't because she got married. She just wanted her daughter, one of her daughters or one of her children to become doctors.
So what was it like for you to go to school then in Lahore?
I did not know a single sentence of the English language. So when I sat there and my mother had done all this research, she was just obsessed about getting education. So she had talked to a few people and she had made a few friends and asked my dad to bring us there just to do a bit of a pilot study to see where my girls will go. And so I was sitting with the vice principal for an interview, grade 7, and she told me to tell her something about myself in English. And I just could not say more than my name is Aisha.
So you've gone from being a very bright girl then in the village to being a kid that really hadn't received commensurate levels of education.
I always used to get an A grade in my village school. And then when I moved here, I failed all subjects. And so my mom had a bit of a reference and the vice principal said, all right, we'll give her a chance, but we'll see how she does.
So what was it, hard work then?
It was absolutely a nightmare. I remember I would cry all day, all night saying, how am I going to do this? Everyone around me in my class, they understand what the teacher is saying. It was an English medium school.
And did you get mocked as a provincial as well?
Not at that time. Later in life, when I got into practical life and I started my career is when I would get mocked, not only because I was a provincial, because of me being a Pashtun.
So you wanted to be a writer at a pretty early age, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did you start writing fiction?
I did. I was about 14 years of age, between 14 and 15. I wrote a story for a writing competition that was a national writing competition. And it was about a young boy who goes to university, falls in love with this voice that he can only hear when he's sitting under the banyan tree. And then I would just try to embody through storytelling the voice that he would hear and what did it look like and how. And so it got selected. And I remember my mom was like, how is a 14-year-old? How can you even explain what's going around when I'm talking about expressing emotions of love? And so it was a metaphor for following a dream. You know it exists. People cannot see it. You can see it. You can feel it. But it's just difficult to convince people that it can become a reality.
Right. So the voice from the banyan tree wasn't a ghost.
It was an inner voice.
It was an inner voice.
That was leading this person. So it was not all love and romance. It was also about believing in yourself.
That sounds lovely. How old were you when you wrote that?
As I said, I was 14 when I started writing it. Wow. At 15, I submitted to a national competition and I won the third prize in there. And then I never stopped. I would write for poetry.com and some of my poems were selected and all that. Although I wanted to be a pilot, I wanted to fly. I just wanted to be a pilot. But damn calculus, it just got to me.
Defeated by calculus. And so many of us have been over the years, Aisha.
Yeah.
So how did your mum encourage your love of books when you were living in Lahore?
Again, stemmed from her love of books. And because I was the oldest child and I was the only child for 4 years, there was a lot of time. She was growing with me. She was 16 when she had me. So from 16 to 20, I think she was exploring. Now that I look back in time, it was not strategic. It was just her exploring books and buying books. And then at the same time, I would accompany her to bookshops, old books, because she couldn't afford. It's not that my family was struggling, but it was never our priority.
So there's a romance with secondhand bookshops, though, isn't there?
Oh, yes, it is. The smell. I mean, to date, it never happens that I see my mom opening a book and not flipping through its pages to just take that smell in. The older the book, the better. And I think I have gotten it from her as well. So yeah, she would bring me books and then she would encourage my father to not bring me toys, but books when he goes to Lahore and he's coming back. So he had started doing a bit of business and even from abroad, because things had started getting better, the family business was booming. So he was traveling abroad.
So that meant you were able to go to university. What was the university you went to like?
So I went to Kinnaird College University for Women in Lahore.
Is it women's only university?
It's women's only. Right. They could not be another way. And I'm so glad that the university existed. It was, and it still continues to be, the best women's university in the country. And so it was merit-based. So you really had to, you know, it was equivalent to the 8R thing that happens in Australia. So you had to have 96 plus 8R to get into that uni. And so I did, and that was another layer of transformation of me understanding how people exist and the social class system, because we didn't have uniforms, unlike other women's universities in Pakistan. This did not. So we could wear whatever we want. And suddenly this religion, the layer of religion comes here as well. Okay, you're a Muslim girl. You should not be wearing these clothes. And then social class, all right, this is, because when we were until high school, it was uniform. So we wouldn't tell if she's coming from a millionaire's family and if she's coming from. But this one, because it was merit-based, so now you had creme de la creme, but they were from different social class.
So then you made the decision to transition from creative writing to journalism. Why was that?
Yeah, so from engineering to when calculus got worst of me or the best of me, whatever. So then I had to make my mind about taking an undergrad degree of where do you want to go? And so my mom really, really, really wanted me to do something related to science or biomedical, something with STEM, you know. And then she even offered me to study geography and become a geologist. Some part of her wanted to be a Nat Geo explorer. And so, she had Nat Geo magazines in our house and she says that she learned a lot to read English from those, you know.
Right. She wants you to be sciencey, but
sciencey. I said, Mom, I'll be sciencey, but social sciencey.
Social sciencey.
So, yeah. And so I even tried going to geology and geography classes for her for a week, but I just couldn't take it. And so journalism. And then I thought, all right, there you go. So I started my journalism undergrad as a cohort of about 86 students, because it was the first year that the university had shifted from a 2-year undergrad to a 4-year honors degree. And so I'm really glad that I could do it.
So the day you graduated from your course, that was also the day you got married.
Yeah.
How old were you when you got married?
I was 22, going on 23.
And how was your husband chosen for you?
So he was chosen through some shared acquaintances. So I think my father's nomadic Wayne, as we call it, would show up every other year or 2 years, and he would just say, I think we don't want to stay here anymore. That's it. The girls have grown up, the boys, we just want to go back to our village. And so my mom didn't want that for us. And I think getting me married into a non-Pashtun family at the time for her meant maybe my daughter will not have to ever face this sword hanging on her head where she has to go back to the village.
Oh.
So let me find her a non-Pashtun family where the girls are educated, where she can live the way she wants to. She can dress up the way. So she will forever be in Lahore.
So she wanted you to get married. So you think she wanted you to get married to give you more independence.
More independence.
Or a hope of independence.
Yes, yes.
But is that the way it worked out?
It didn't, because, again, I think she didn't realize and I didn't realize, and my father partly did, but as always, he always gave in to my mother, because he always says that your mother has always done such a great job with you guys, so I trust her. But I think, again, here is the Pashtun, non-Pashtun divide, because when you're living in a country, intermarriages, inter-ethnic marriages tend to happen. And so we opened our hearts and how I was the first, I am on record, the first woman in my entire generation to be married into a non-Pashtun family. So that was a very big thing. And a lot of my family were not happy that with my parents that they were taking this decision. But, you know, the love for your child comes first. And I think that's really helped us throughout.
So
it didn't work. It didn't work because of the clash. It was literally a clash of civilization. It was a clash of thought process, of how values, of how we look at life, of how independent I feel and how I wanted to navigate my life.
So he was unwilling for you to work as a journalist?
Oh, then. Of course. He said anything to do with men and around men is not allowed.
So how did you convince him to let you do it?
He said the only thing you're allowed is teaching. And I, at school, in a girl's school, I didn't want to do it, because that was not my line of profession. But I ended up accepting it because I just wanted to get out of the house. I wanted to do something. Although I was fired from my first job because I was spending too much time with students instead of the common room with teachers. And so I started freelancing. And then that started bringing a bit of money. But at the same time, I think I also started talking to his dad and convincing him. His dad used to work for the military, by the way. He was a military officer, retired. And I would convince him. Both his sisters were working. So it took me time to convince, but there was a lot of, I don't know if the word post-nups exist or not, but I had to sign them a lot, like literally sign them on a piece of paper that I will not talk to a man, I will not share my number with a man, I will not call anyone male in the house.
Signed that?
I did, literally, on a piece of paper.
You couldn't have meant it. You can't possibly be a journalist and do that.
I mean, this was just a paper. It didn't mean anything, right? But these are the bargains that I had to make for me to come out as in my career and do what I want to, and a legitimate thing. I mean, I had, as I said, a gold medal in my master's for this, and I was already getting freelance opportunities from. So I think it took me a couple of years to convince him, and I did.
So that's when you got your first job at the Express Tribune, which was an international partner of the New York Times.
Yeah.
And what beat did they put you on?
So at the start, it was a city desk. So I had to cover regional news. Then I was moved into crime, regional crime desk as well. The only desk I had asked my editor not to put me on was the sports desk, because I said, it just doesn't make sense to me. And I remember he did the next day.
Well, talk about controversial in Pakistan, saying something like that. The most cricket-mad nation in the world.
Sports are very political. Sports in Pakistan is very political.
So the partnership this paper had with the New York Times, was that how you got sent to Afghanistan for the first time?
No. How I was sent was that there was a German non-for-profit organization, Friedrich Ebert Stiftung. This was a kind of a fellowship program that they were running. And so they were recruiting early career journalists, young journalists from different formats, from different medias. And so my editor was asked to nominate five people, only one of them would be selected. So this is how their selection process was throughout. And I think some of the things that I had done at the newspaper probably got his attention, and then he nominated my name for it. But it was through a couple of interviews and then a writing story that we were selected. So there were 11 journalists from Pakistan, from across the country, from different media broadcasters. They were selected to go and spend time in Afghanistan, and 11 from Afghanistan who had to come, and we had to then become buddies for them in Pakistan.
And how are you feeling about being selected to go to Afghanistan? This is your homeland, but you'd never been there before. It was a dangerous but massively interesting place. We're talking about 2012 here, isn't it? 2012. So this is 11 years after the Taliban had been kicked out by the invasion of the US and its allies.
Yeah.
So this was a really interesting time, a dangerous place to go. You must have been going out of your mind with excitement.
I was jumping in elation, and I was just, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. This was the time when, for the first time, the US had announced that they will withdraw in 2014 So it was all about US is about to withdraw. There are 2 years left. What are we going to do? So it was all about withdrawal, 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 which, of course, took many, many, many years. And it was also around the time when Malala Yousafzai was shot. And it was also during the time when Imran Khan announced that if I become the prime minister, I'm going to give citizenship to all Afghan refugees. A lot was happening.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
You're going to a homeland you've never been to before. Was that strange for you?
It was. This was just personal awakening. I could just feel the minute I landed, there was something. And it's not cliche. I know it sounds like that. But I felt like I'm home for the first time. And a lot of our listeners who are migrants or who have had the similar experience would relate with that.
Yeah, I've had friends tell me that, about going to the place that they'd never been to before, that their family had come from. They had this wonderful sense of homecoming. But it doesn't last very long because you sort of, after a little while, you begin to realise you haven't grown up there.
No.
And you don't have that kind of the biography attached to the place. Is that what happened to you?
It did. Because the first thing was that when I would introduce myself as someone who comes from an Afghan family, the first question would be, but you don't speak like an Afghan, because I do speak the Pashto language, but growing up in the Pakistani side, it is a different dialect.
So it's just the language of family for you?
It was. So I was deprived from that language. And then from then on, two things were happening. I was covering stories about human suffering, but at the same time, I was just making attempts to be accepted. It was a learning experience. It was a learning journey. I learned a lot. I also learned a lot about the stereotypes that I had internalized about Afghans. I also broke a lot of preconceived notions and confirmation biases that I had.
Like what?
For instance, all Afghans hate Pakistanis because they're hateful people, not realizing what the context is.
Did you believe that?
I believed that Afghans hate Pakistan, people from in Pakistan. I didn't believe it, but there was this level of information that had been internalized in not to trust what they're saying when they're talking to you. But it's only when I started sitting among those people and going there and the hospitality, and the first time I entered there, there was an Afghan journalist who called me, he said, "Salam Aisha Jan." Salam is a way of saying hello.
Peace be with you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and Aisha Jan, so the word Jan in Urdu language means heart, life, right? Which is used for a romantic partner. Right?
So he's calling you dear heart, was he?
So he, when he said that, I was taken aback. So that's the level of unfamiliarity that I had with the culture. And so at first time, I thought he was just probably trying to flirt. But it's only after a couple of days that I realized that no, calling someone Jan with their name in the Afghan culture means that you are giving them utmost respect. You're telling them that you are worthy of respect and love in a patriotic way. So if I called you Richard Jan, that means I'm showing you my respect. It was as small as that. And so now I do use the word Jan when I talk to people.
So when you got there to Afghanistan, that was 11 years after the US invasion and its allies had invaded and pushed out the Taliban regime. What was the country like at that point?
It was still a mess. I mean, only Kabul or Mazar-e-Sharif cannot be taken as the only representations of how life is, you know.
The Taliban was still active in the countryside.
They were active in different parts, countryside, yes. And so if you want to know what the condition of the people is on the condition of the people that live in regional areas. And it was bad. You could see that there was hardly any repair or reconstruction of buildings there. We would move from compound to compound, so the French compound, the US compound, the German compound, and that's what it's called. So it's fenced and gated. So there's one level of gated security and the other and the third and then frisking and then everything. And then once you're in there, you do not feel that you're in Afghanistan. You feel like you're in some part of a French village with the most amazing wine and olives and cheese. And I had one of my best pizzas, Italian pizzas,
in Afghanistan.
Right. In a compound, which was a French compound, but they had Italian stuff.
So there's this strange air of unreality in the regions and the countryside then as a result. What about Kabul, though? What was life like? Because the reports I saw from Kabul at the time looked like the place was fizzing, actually, with new media organizations and other institutions being sprouting up. Yeah. Is that what you saw?
Yeah. There were young people everywhere. Every corner of the road, in my experience, I remember, had these language classes. So enroll in Russian, enroll in Chinese, enroll in German. So all these forces that you had, or any opportunities of finding a better life somewhere in other parts of the world.
And rejoining the rest of the world too.
And rejoining the rest of the world as well. Don't quote me on this, but I think more than half of the young people in Afghanistan wanted to be interpreters at that time, because that was the job that would give you thousands of dollars. And it would also give you that security in a way. But also, if something happens to the country, then you may have someone to help you
get out,
right? Although I think at that time, people did not have that in mind, because at that time that had become their reality. They did not want the US forces to leave, because they knew this is what's going to happen. And they did not want to leave the country. There was music on the streets. I could hear it. I remember after a long day of work, some of our fellow journalists, we would just go out and say, let's have some pomegranate. Afghanistan is the heaven for pomegranates, like rubies coming out of a fruit. I had one of the best handmade ice cream there. So we could, you know, we still had to cover ourselves, like not the face, but the head. We could be in our jeans as long as our shirts are long enough to cover our back and as long as our toes are not showing. It was thriving. And the young people were making it thrive.
Tell me about the garden in Kabul you used to go to.
Oh, so there are two gardens that I got almost addicted to. I had to visit them every day. One of them is called the Baghi Zanana, which means women's garden. That was a walled, fenced garden. Only women were allowed to go in there with young children. And then inside, the women who had lost the men in their house, or who, you know, the earners, the male earners of the family, they were allowed to set up small businesses, like selling handmade things, embroideries, you name it, and they had it. So one of my stories was on how these women are surviving in this. Also inside that space, you had vocational training institutes as well. So you could learn English, or you could learn how to sew, and you could learn how to do other things.
And what did these women tell you about how life had been under the Taliban?
It was as if I was living their nightmares. There was one woman who was about in her late 70s, and she said that she's still, every day for the 11, 12 years since the Taliban had been removed, she has the same nightmare, which is her as a young woman running, and a Talib, which is a singular for one Talib, you know, a member of the Taliban, with this big baton running after her, because this is what had happened to her. She had been charged with these sticks and batons many, many times, looking for her husband who was missing. So these women just sitting there, sharing their stories, hardly making any money, but enough to make sure that the children don't go to sleep without any food. And I am forced to think about what would have happened to those women, because those women are not, now women are not allowed to go out. I mean, Taliban have jails full of such women who have children in their hands begging for food because they don't know how to earn money, and then imprisoning them on fake charges of prostitution. And so you go to Kabul and other parts of the country, you have jails full of women, and they don't know what they have done. But these women say, at least we're getting some food in there. At least our children are not dying out of hunger.
It still couldn't have been a very safe place for foreign journalists, let alone foreign female journalists like yourself. Were you at risk from Taliban agents striking at you, attempting to kidnap you while you were reporting in Kabul?
Yes, just like any other journalist, but a bit more so because I had traveled with a group of journalists from Pakistan. So there was this rumor that one of these is a spy for the military intelligence. And so to date, I don't know if one of us was or not. But now that I realize that these things just don't become rumors like that. There must be some thread that goes and connects. And I think that had come from a Facebook post, from a Facebook check-in that was made by one of the journalists who came with us. And she happened to be a daughter of a military general. She was a very good friend. So I'm almost 99.9% sure that she wasn't the one. And then we were told not to put any check-ins. I don't used to have social media at that time because I was not allowed to have social media at that time.
Well, don't check in and advertise your presence in a specific place.
In a specific place, checking on social media and tagging people.
Tell me about how close you came to being kidnapped. What made you concerned that you might be in trouble?
So that girl and I had kind of made a pact with each other saying, okay, wherever we go, we're going to go together. So I will be there with you when you are doing your stories and you will be there with me just so that there is one more person if something goes wrong. So one of the stories that I did was I was going to talk to a young women in civil services waiting to become bureaucrats. So I went to the Foreign Affairs Department and she was with me. So I talked to a few women, young girls who had just become. So we were just coming out of that place when we decided that we wanted to go to Baghe Babur. Now, this is again another garden. So this is where the Mughal Emperor Babur is buried. And his tomb is on the top of the hill. So there are about 150 stairs that take you there. So I wanted to go there because I also wanted to do something about this Mughal connection. So we were being chased by three young men and they were on a yellow superbike. And it is very uncommon for someone to have a yellow superbike in Afghanistan. We're talking about a war-torn country, right? So
what is a superbike?
A heavy bike.
So it's like a racing motorbike, in other words.
A racing motorbike, yeah. And so initially, again, as growing up in a patriarchal society, which is not very safe for women on the streets, my first instinct was maybe it's just a couple of young boys, men, who are just following us, which can be pretty standard in that part of the world.
What made you think it was more sinister than that?
It was the look on their face. And what made me think about they was not safe is that they were on the phone with someone. And then I noticed one of them take a picture as well, not of us, but to show where we were just entering. And that's when I thought that this is not right because nobody would just take a picture and they were constantly on the phone. And they just disappeared. They would disappear. And then after 10 minutes, they would just reappear somewhere. Then after some time, I noticed that now they were not only the three of them, there was another taxi with them. So in Afghanistan at that time, private taxis had started. And so suddenly after they appeared and disappeared twice. The third time, they also had that with them. And that is when I felt, has it come so that we can be shoved into this?
Right, because you're going to be bundled into that damn thing. You must have been very frightened.
At that time, I think I got really frightened when I saw that taxi because I thought, all right, they can't take us on a bike. So maybe this is why the taxi is here. But at that time, the only thing that was going through my head was, I just hope they don't pluck my nails, because that was one of the strategies that I had heard that they used to get information out. And I was thinking, what would I tell them? I don't even know anything. Maybe my Pashto will save me. Maybe I'll say I'm one of you.
But you'd gone through the gate to this garden.
So I went into the gate and then I thought this was the only way to disappear into this garden because it was public place and it was, you know, a lot of people. And then that's where we contacted one of our fellow journalists and said that we've got into trouble and he confirmed that, yes, you're being chased by the intelligence. But
intelligence? Whose intelligence service?
Well, at that time, it could have been the Afghan intelligence, but this could also have been the Taliban. But I don't think so. The Taliban were so resourceful to be following people. Or it's the Afghan intelligence saying, this is the Pakistani spy and we need to keep an eye, we need to interrogate her. And maybe they thought a woman was an easier target because you can get information out. And I would even think about, what if they pluck my nails? What am I going to say?
So all this is running through your head?
Running through my head.
You're trying to figure out as you're going up the steps to this?
So we were going up the steps and then we sat with the guards there until someone would confirm that they had sent a car. And so then I received a call from someone from the Pakistani embassy and said that we've sent you a car, you're being chased, and you are not allowed to go anywhere else but directly sit into that car. This is the car number, this is the color, this is the registration plate, and we have our person in there. And so I and that girl, we went in, we saw that guy that we had met at the Pakistani embassy a day before. We were then sent to where we were staying. And so then we were told not to go out alone.
So after this incident, how did this lead you to kind of change your whole approach to what you thought you should do with journalism?
I just realized that journalism is not as easy as people outside the profession think it is. I also realize that there are different ways of doing journalism. I also realize that one formula for journalism cannot work in different contexts. And I also realize that you need to know a bit of the language of that country. But I also realized that the media rhetoric was dominated by warmongering and conflict and the Taliban and what these countries want that have stakes, and was hardly about what the people were going through. It was 11 years into the American invasion of the country, and people were still struggling to find food. And then I realized, I need to write about this. And that's what I was writing about. I was writing about the first female presidential candidate, Fawzia Koofi, at that time, whose husband was shot during her electoral campaign. I was covering stories of these young women in parliament. I was covering stories of these young women in foreign office that were trained to become foreign officers. And I was just smitten with their charismatic personalities. And at the peak of the democratic government of Dr. Ashraf Ghani, there were 27% women in the parliament. Yeah. And this tells you the potential of the young Afghans. This just changed how the young Afghans look at their country, look at other countries, and also how what they want for their own country. They may be dispersed across the world, but there is no stopping them from coming together and mobilizing for a country that has the right to exist in sovereignty.
So how did this realization eventually bring you to Australia, Aisha?
So when I went back to Pakistan and I started looking at how all that information had been curated into reporting and how the reports did not match reality, is when I started looking at how media frames different aspects and political parallelism where media and politics are aligned and alignment and propaganda and all that. So I wanted to do some research. And at the same time, in my personal life, I was really struggling with my first marriage. It was getting to a point where I just wanted to run away. And so I wanted to run away to the farthest country possible where nobody would reach. Then I got an offer for admission because my proposal, my research proposal, was accepted at the University of Wollongong here. It was also accepted a couple of other places in Canada as well. But no, God, no, I just wanted to be in Australia. And then I started, you know, touching on these subjects in my PhD journey while I was also at the same time running away from a marriage that was turning very violent. And it was not good for me as it was not good for my ex-husband. We were both growing. And again, I use a metaphor for my first marriage as we were young. So the seeds were sown. But when it was growing into a tree, my branch was tilted completely into a different direction than of my ex-husband. And so we were just two people put in a relationship at the wrong time, two people who shouldn't have been. We had completely different school of thoughts. And so I came here, did my PhD. When I came here, I realized that I was pregnant. So while trying to run away from that and adhering to whatever my ex-husband was saying, all right, everything's going to be fine. Just let me go to Australia. And so I found out that I was pregnant, and this was another thing. Oh, my God. All right. Now I have to deal with this as well. So I decided not to defer my degree. I was given an option to defer my semester. I didn't. So I came here, started my PhD, gave birth here. There was no support at that time. My sister's visa was rejected. I wanted her to come over. It was the most difficult time of my life, navigating as a single mom, as a PhD candidate, on an international student visa.
And a woman trying to untangle herself from her husband.
And untangle myself from my husband from a very bad marriage that was just getting worse. And then also try to do my PhD, but also be good at it. But then at the same time, I knew that the only constant thing in my life is my career, things that I love doing. And during the same time, I was also lucky to be offered a position of a casual radio and digital producer at SBS Language Radio. So I was working for SBS Urdu. That also then again, as a researcher, you know, that gave me an insight into the issues of the South Asian community. And I then got even closer with the Afghan diaspora here. And I've built a lot of connections with the Afghan diaspora in Australia through that job.
So you've since remarried.
I have.
Aisha. How did you meet your second husband?
Oh, so I joined a book club. It was predominantly members from South Asian countries. And so he's an Afghan. I just fell in love with him the day I started talking to him, honestly. He was born here. He comes from a family of the Afghan warlords. And I did not know. At that time, I had no idea what family he comes from.
But he's the son of a warlord?
He is a son. He's a grandson of the former prime minister of the country, Gulbuddin right. Hikmatyar.
Was he part of the Northern Alliance that came in and ran over the Taliban with the US
he was. He was not part of the Northern Alliance. He was the one who also attacked Kabul while the Alliance was also attacking Kabul, right? And so he's called the Butcher of Kabul. So if you go on a search engine and write Butcher of Kabul, there you go, his grandfather.
Your husband's grandfather was called the Butcher of Kabul.
The Butcher of Kabul. And my father-in-law, my husband's father, he was the main person of the jihadi political party that they had, Hizb-e Islami, right?
And were you daunted by that?
When I first met him, I did not know that he came from that. I just fell in love with him. But it was primarily because of our discussions on books. We were talking about, you know, philosophy and religion and politics and all that. But my husband is against the jihadi school of thought. He is an engineer by profession. He works for big tech. But he also does political activism. And I think the fall of Kabul really triggered that in him.
And how does his family back home feel about you?
Oh, yeah. They were not happy. They didn't want him to get married to a woman who had already been married and then had sought divorce from her ex-husband and was now a mother to a child who didn't cover herself. So, no, they weren't happy.
How about your family?
My family had seen me suffer. So, for them, these things didn't matter. For them, what mattered was if I was happy or not. And I remember I gave my father a call and I said, Abdullah, my husband now, is going to give you a call seeking for your permission to marry me. Be as critical as you can. Be the father. Don't be the friend. Be the father. And then he said, oh, yeah, I know how to be critical. You don't teach me how to be critical. And then Abdullah just won his heart. And then after 5 minutes, my dad called and he said, that's it. You're going to marry this guy. So they're very happy to see me happy, to see me feel safe and thrive.
You say that there's this fantastic saying in your language, which is, if you're going to have camels as pets, you need to build high walls. What does it mean?
So in Pashto, I would like to say it, you know, cha ushan lare, peba darwaze chige lare. That means when you're going to get yourself into serious things, bigger things, they're not petty things, politics, changing the way people look at the world, challenging the status quo, making them accountable for what they've done, like my husband is doing to his grandfather now. He's taken the Afghan media by storm because, you know, he's the first ever in the history of the country to come out from a jihadi family and then stand against them and then vouch for younger people and democracy. So we do get a lot of hate, of course. I got a lot of hate from my husband's family. When you're dealing with such powerful people, when you're dealing with such powerful narratives in the media, when you're dealing with the status quo, that means you're in it not only for long, but you really have to show that resistance. You have to be strong enough. With that appreciation and praise and acknowledgement will also come hate and abuse.
It sounds like there's more than enough love to go around, though, to work against all of that. Mm. As I've been talking to you, I've been sort of realizing, and this is something I don't think we ever really got in the reporting on the travails of Afghanistan in over the last 20, 30 years or so, is what a complex interaction there is of cross loyalties from religion to tribal loyalties to language loyalties to geographic loyalties. What does that ultimately mean for a place like Afghanistan and the world you're from? Does that make change incredibly hard as a result?
It does, of course, because then you're fighting your battle on different fronts, front, back, right, left, up, down, everybody. And so you're not only fighting physically, but also ideologically. And for that, you also then have to work on your new, younger generation to be able to be with you and understand what's happening to them. We are here, for example, we, and I say we as in people like me, we're in Australia. We're in one of the best countries in the world. We have been very lucky to call this place our home, but not everyone is. So this is our way of passing on that favor and that. So it is complex, very complex, and that's why it's not going to just take band-aid solutions. 20 years, the American forces were there, right? Giving people a bit more freedom to do what they want to do, relatively. And it was still not enough. Look at how it was just swept with one coming of the Taliban. the same Taliban that the country was invaded for and the same Taliban who are now handed over the country in a tray. And so things have become worse because the people now know better. They have social media, which was not something that they had in the 90s. They've had education. They have learned languages. They've seen what a better life can look like. And I think this is what the Ghani government has done to the younger Afghan generation, to make them realize what it means to have your own country and to live in your own country, to be proud of and wanting to grow your children in your own country and not living a life of a refugee. A life of an Afghan refugee is, I'm sorry to say, one of the worst ways to live a life, even if you're living in one of the best countries in the world. And this is what they want. Most of these people did not want to. They're too grounded with their land, like indigenous people. They don't want to be removed from their land. Their land is sacred. It's everything for them. So that's why I talk about in my research about deliberative practices in journalism, to peel the layers one by one and not as a whole, because that's impossible.
It's been lovely speaking with you, Aisha. Thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
It started with a Saturday lunch. It ended with three people dead. The suspected cause, allegedly, poisonous mushrooms. The cook, Erin Patterson, has been charged with murder and attempted murder. She says she's innocent.
I'm devastated. I love them.
I'm Christian Silva, host of the new ABC podcast Mushroom Case Daily, the podcast that follows the case of Erin Patterson as it happens. And if and when it heads to a full trial, we'll be there daily. To be the first to hear updates, follow Mushroom Case Daily on the ABC Listen app.